lords and laws. He will not even bestir himself to sire an heir. Queen Eleanor prays daily at the great sept, beseeching the mother above to bless her with a child, yet she remains a maid. Aerys keeps his own apartments, and it is said that he would sooner take a book to bed than any woman. He filled his cup again. Make no mistake, 'tis Lord Rivers who rules us with his spells and spies. There is no one to oppose him. Prince Maker sulks at Summer Hall, nursing his grievances against his royal brother. Prince Rhaegal is as meek as he is mad, and his children are, well, children. Friends and favourites of Lord Rivers fill every office. The lords of the small council lick his hand, and this new grand maester is as steeped in sorcery as he is. The Red Keep is garrisoned by Raven's Teeth, and no man sees the king without his leave. Dunk shifted uncomfortably in his seat. How many eyes does Lord Bloodraven have? 1,000 eyes and one. He hoped the king's hand did not have 1,000 ears and one as well. Some of what Septon Sefton was saying sounded treasonous. He glanced at Egg to see how he was taking all of this. The boy was struggling with all his might to hold his tongue. The Septon pushed himself to his feet. My good sister will be a while yet. As with all great ladies, the first 10 gowns she tries will be found not to suit her mood. Will you take more wine? Without waiting for an answer, he refilled both cups. The lady I mistook, said Dunk, anxious to speak of something else. Is she your sister? We are all children of the Seven, sir, but apart from that, dear me, no. Lady Hellicent was sister to Sir Roland Uffering, Lady Rohan's fourth husband, who died in the spring. My brother was his predecessor, Sir Simon Staunton, who had the great misfortune to choke upon a chicken bone. Coldmoat crawls with revenants, it must be said. The husbands die, yet their kin remain to drink my lady's wines and eat her sweetmeats like a plague of plump pink locusts done up in silk and velvet. He wiped his mouth. And yet, she must wed again, and soon. Must, said Dunk. Her lord father's will demands it. Lord Wyman wanted grandsons to carry on his line. When he sickened, he tried to wed her to the Long Inch, so he might die knowing that she had a strong man to protect her, but Rohan refused to have him. His lordship took his vengeance in his will. If she remains unwed on the second anniversary of her father's passing, Coldmoat and its lands pass to his cousin Wendell. Perhaps you glimpsed him in the yard, a short man with a goiter on his neck, much given to flatulence. Though it is small of me to say so. I am cursed with excess wind myself. Be that as it may, Sir Wendell is grasping and stupid, but his lady wife is Lord Rowan's sister, and damnably fertile. That cannot be denied. She whelps as often as he farts. Their sons are quite as bad as he is, their daughters worse, and all of them have begun to count the days. Lord Rowan has upheld the will, so her ladyship as only till the next new moon. Why has she waited so long? Dunk wondered aloud. The Septon shrugged. If truth be told, there has been a dearth of suitors. My good sister is not hard to look upon, you will have noticed, and a stout castle and broad lands add to her charms. You would think that younger sons and landless knights would swarm about her ladyship like flies. You would be wrong. The 4 dead husbands make them wary, and there are those who will say that she is barren, too, though never in her hearing, unless they yearn to see the inside of a crow cage. She has carried 2 children to term, a boy and a girl, but neither lived to see a name day. Those few who are not put off by talk of poisonings and sorcery want no part of the Long Inch. Lord Wyman charged him on his deathbed to protect his daughter from unworthy suitors, which he has taken to mean all suitors. Any man who means to have her hand would need to face his sword first. He finished his wine and set the cup aside. That is not to say there has been no one. Clayton Caswell and Simon Laygood have been the most persistent, though they seem more interested in her lands than in her person. Were I given to wagering, I should place my gold on Gerald Lannister. He has yet to put in an appearance, but they say he is golden-haired and quick of wit, and more than 6 feet tall. And Lady Webber is much taken with his letters. The lady in question stood in the doorway beside a homely young maester with a great hooked nose. You would lose your wager, good brother. Gerald will never willingly forsake the pleasures of Lannisport and the splendour of Casterly Rock for some little lordship. He has more influence as Lord Tybalt's brother and adviser than he could ever hope for as my husband. As for the others, Sir Simon would need to sell off half my land to pay his debts, and Sir Clayton trembles like a leaf whenever the Long Inch deigns to look his way. Besides, he is prettier than I am. And you, Septon, have the biggest mouth in Westeros. A large belly requires a large mouth, said Septon Sefton, utterly unabashed. Else it soon becomes a small one.
Are you the Red Widow? Egg asked, astonished. I'm near as tall as you are.
Another boy made that same observation not half a year ago. I sent him to the rack to make him taller. When Lady Rohan settled onto the high seat on the dais, she pulled her braid forward over her left shoulder. It was so long that the end of it lay coiled in her lap like a sleeping cat. Sir Duncan, I should not have teased you in the yard when you were trying so hard to be gracious. It was only that you blushed so red. Was there no girl to tease you in the village where you grew so tall?
The village was King's Landing.
He did not mention Flea Bottom. There were girls, but the sort of teasing that went on in Flea Bottom sometimes involved cutting off a toe.
I expect they were afraid to tease you.
Lady Rohan stroked her braid. No doubt they were frightened of your size. Do not think ill of Lady Hellicent, I pray you. My good sister is a simple creature, but she has no harm in her. For all her piety, she could not dress herself without her scepters.
It was not her doing. The mistake was mine.
You lie most gallantly. I know it was Sir Lucas. He is a man of cruel humours, and you offended him on sight.
How? Dunk said, puzzled. I never did him any harm.
She smiled a smile that made him wish you were plainer. I saw you standing with him. You're taller, by a hand, or near enough. It has been a long while since Sir Lucas met anyone he could not look down on.
How old are you, sir?
Near 20, if it please m'lady. Dunk liked the ring of 20, though most like he was a year younger, maybe 2. No one knew for certain, least of all him. He must have had a mother and a father like everybody else, but he'd never known them, not even their names, and no one in Flea Bottom had ever cared much when he'd been born, or to whom.
Are you as strong as you appear?
How strong do I appear, m'lady?
Oh, strong enough to annoy Sir Lucas. He is my castellan, though not by choice. Like Coldmoat, he is a legacy of my father.
Did you come to knighthood on some battlefield, Sir Duncan? Your speech suggests that you were not born of noble blood, if you will forgive my saying so.
I was born of gutter blood. A hedge knight named Sir Arlan of Pennytree took me on to squire for him when I was just a boy. He taught me chivalry and the arts of war.
And this same Sir Arlan knighted you?
Dunk shuffled his feet. One of his boots was half unlaced, he saw. No one else was like to do it.
Where is Sir Arlan now?
He died.
He raised his eyes. He could lace his boot up later.
I buried him on a hillside.
Did he fall valiantly in battle?
There were rains. He caught a chill.
Old men are frail, I know. I learned that from my second husband. I was 13 when we wed. He would have been 55 on his next name day had he lived long enough to see it. When he was half a year in the ground, I gave him a little son. But the stranger came for him as well. The Septons said his father wanted him beside him.
What do you think, sir?
Well, Dunk said hesitantly, that might be, m'lady.
Nonsense, she said. The boy was born too weak. Such a tiny thing. He scarce had strength enough to nurse.
Still, the gods gave his father 55 years. You would think they might have granted more than 3 days to the son.
You would.
Dunk knew little and less about the gods. He went to Sept sometimes and prayed to the warrior to lend strength to his arms, but elsewise he let the 7 be.
I am sorry your Sir Arlan died, she said, and sorrier still that you took service with Sir Eustace.
All old men are not the same, Sir Duncan. You would do well to go home to Pennytree.
I have no home but where I swear by sword.
Dunk had never seen Pennytree. He couldn't even say if it was in the reach.
Swear it here, then. The times are uncertain.
I have need of knights. You look as though you have a healthy appetite, Sir Duncan. How many chickens can you eat? At Coldmoat you would have your fill of warm pink meat and sweet fruit tarts. Your squire looks in need of sustenance as well. He is so scrawny that all his hair has fallen out. We'll have him share a cell with other boys of his own age. He'll like that. My master-at-arms can train him in all the arts of war.
I train him, said Dunk defensively.
And who else? Bennis? Old Osgray? The chickens?
There had been days when Dunk had set Egg to chasing chickens. It helps make him quicker, he thought, but he knew that if he said it, she would laugh. She was distracting him with her snub nose and her freckles. Dunk had to remind himself of why Sir Eustace had sent him here. My sword is sworn to my Lord of Osgray, m'lady, he said, and that's the way it is.
So be it, sir. Let us speak of less pleasant matters.
Lady Rohan gave her braid a tug.
We do not suffer attacks on Coldmoat or its people. So tell me why I should not have you sewn in a sack.
I came to parley, he reminded her, and I have drunk your wine. The taste still lingered in his mouth, rich and sweet. So far, it had not poisoned him. Perhaps it was the wine that made him bold. And you don't have a sack big enough for me. To his relief, Egg's jape made her smile.
I have several that are big enough for Bennis, though. Maester Serric says Walmer's face was sliced open almost to the bone.
Sir Bennis lost his temper with the man, m'lady. Sir Eustace sent me here to pay the blood price.
The blood price, she laughed. He is an old man, I know, but I had not realized he was so old as that. Does he think we are living in the age of heroes, when a man's life was reckoned to be worth no more than a sack of silver?
The digger was not killed, m'lady, Dunk reminded her. No one was killed that I saw. His face was cut, is all.
Her fingers danced idly along her braid.
How much does Sir Eustace reckon Walmer's cheek to be worth, pray?
One silver stag, and three for you, m'lady.
Sir Eustace sets a niggard's price upon my honour, though three silvers are better than three chickens, I grant you. He would do better to deliver Bennis up to me for chastisement.
Would this involve that sack you mentioned?
It might. She coiled her braid around one hand. Osgray can keep his silver. Only blood can pay for blood.
Well, said Dunk, it may be as you say, m'lady, but why not send for that man that Bennis cut, and ask him if he'd sooner have a silver stag or Bennis in a sack?
Oh, he'd pick the silver if he couldn't have both. I don't doubt that, sir. It is not his choice to make. This is about the lion and the spider now, not some peasant's cheek. It is Bennis I want, and Bennis I shall have. No one rides onto my lands, does harm to one of mine, and escapes to laugh about it.
Your ladyship rode on to Standfast Land and did harm of one of Sir Eustace's, Dunk said, before he stopped to think about it.
Did I? She tugged her braid again. If you mean the sheep-stealer, the man was notorious. I had twice complained to Osgray, yet he did nothing. I do not ask thrice. The king's law grants me the power of pit and gallows.
It was Egg who answered her.
On your own lands? The boy insisted. The king's law gives lords the power of pit and gallows on their own lands. Clever boy, she said. If you know that much, you will also know that landed knights have no right to punish without their liege lord's leave. Sir Eustace holds Standfast of Lord Rowan. Bennis broke the king's peace when he drew blood and must answer for it. She looked at Dunk. If Sir Eustace will deliver Bennis to me, I'll slit his nose, and that will be the end of it. If I must come and take him, I make no such promise.
Dunk had a sudden sick feeling in the pit of his stomach.
I will tell him, but he won't give up Sir Bennis, he hesitated. The dam was the cause of all the trouble. If your ladyship would consent to take it down,
impossible, declared the young maester by Lady Rohan's side. Coldmoat supports 20 times as many small folk as does Standfast. Her ladyship has fields of wheat and corn and barley, all dying from the drought. She has half a dozen orchards, apples and apricots, and three kinds of pears. She has cows about to calf, 500 head of black-nosed sheep, and she breeds the finest horses in the reach. We have a dozen mares about to foal.
Sir Eustace has sheep too, Dunk said. He has melons in the fields, beans and barley corn, and—
You were taking water for the moat, Egg said loudly.
I was getting to the moat, Dunk thought.
The moat is essential to Coldmoat's defences, the maester insisted.
Do you suggest that Lady Rohan leave herself open to attack in such uncertain times as these?
Well, Dunk said slowly, a dry moat is still a moat, and Milady has strong walls with ample men to defend them.
Sir Duncan, Lady Rohan said, I was 10 years old when the Black Dragon rose. I begged my father not to put himself at risk, or at least to leave my husband. Who would protect me if both my men were gone? So he took me up onto the ramparts and pointed out Cold Moat's strong points. Keep them strong, he said, and they will keep you safe. If you see to your defences, no man may do you harm. The first thing he pointed at was the moat. She stroked her cheek with the tail of her braid. My first husband perished on the red grass field. My father found me others, but the stranger took them too. I no longer trust in men, no matter how ample they may seem. I trust in stone and steel and water. I trust in moats, sir, and mine will not go dry.
What your father said, that's well and good, said Dunk, but it doesn't give you the right to take Osgrey water.
She tugged her braid. I suppose Sir Eustace told you that the stream was his.
For 1,000 years, said Dunk. It's named the Checky Water. That's plain.
So it is. She tugged again, once, twice, thrice. As the river is called the Mander, though the Manderleys were driven from its banks 1,000 years ago. High Garden is still High Garden, though the last gardener died on the field of fire. Casterly Rock teems with Lannisters, and nowhere a Casterly to be found. The world changes, sir. This Checky Water rises in the Horseshoe Hills, which were wholly mine when last I looked. The water is mine as well. Maester Serric, show him. The maester descended from the dais. He could not have been much older than Dunk, but in his grey robes and chain collar he had an air of sombre wisdom that belied his years. In his hands was an old parchment. See for yourself, sir, he said as he unrolled it and offered it to Dunk. Dunk the Lunk, thick as a castle wall. He felt his cheeks reddening again. Gingerly he took parchment from the maester and scowled at the writing. Not a word of it was intelligible to him, but he knew the wax seal beneath the ornate signature, the three-headed dragon of House Targaryen, the king's seal. He was looking at a royal decree of some sort. Dunk moved his head from side to side, so they would think he was reading.
There's a word here I can't make out, he muttered after a moment. Egg, come have a look. You have sharper eyes than me.
The boy darted to his side. Which word, sir? Dunk pointed.
That one?
Oh. Egg read quickly, then raised his eyes to Dunk's and gave a little nod. It is her stream. She has a paper. Dunk felt as though he'd been punched in the stomach. The king's own seal.
There must be some mistake. The old man's sons died in service to the king. Why would his grace take his stream away?
If King Darren had been a less forgiving man, he should have lost his head as well. For half a heartbeat, Dunk was lost.
What do you mean?
She means, said Maester Serric, that Sir Eustace Osgrey is a rebel and a traitor. Sir Eustace chose the Black Dragon over the Red in the hope that a Blackfyre king might restore the lands and castles that the Osgreys had lost under the Targaryens, Lady Rohan said. Chiefly, he wanted Coldmoat. His sons paid for his treason with their life's blood. When he brought their bones home and delivered his daughter to the king's men for a hostage, his wife threw herself from the top of Standfast Tower.
Did Sir Eustace tell you that?
Her smile was sad. No, I did not think so.
The Black Dragon. You swore your sword to a traitor, Lunk. You ate a traitor's bread and slept beneath a rebel's roof.
Milady, he said, groping. The Black Dragon? That was 15 years ago. This is now, and there's a drought. Even if he was a rebel once, Sir Eustace still needs water.
The Red Widow rose and smoothed her skirts. He had best pray for rain, then.
That was when Dunk recalled Osgrey's parting words in the wood. If he will not grant him a share of the water for his own sake, do it for his son.
His son?
Adam. He served here as your father's page and squire.
Lady Rohan's face was stone.
Come closer.
He did not know what else to do but to obey. The dais added a good foot to her height, yet even so Dunk towered over her.
Kneel, she said.
He did. The slap she gave him had all her strength behind it, and she was stronger than she looked. His cheek burned, and he could taste blood in his mouth from a broken lip, but she hadn't truly hurt him. For a moment, all Dunk could think of was grabbing her by that long red braid and pulling her across his lap to slap her ass, as you would a spoiled child. If I do, she'll scream, though, and 20 knights will come bursting in to kill me. You dare appeal to me in Adam's name? Her nostrils flared. Remove yourself from Coldmoat, sir, at once. I never meant go, or I will find a sack large enough for you if I have to sew one up myself. Tell Sir Eustace to bring me Bennis of the Brown Shield by the morrow, else I will come for him myself with fire and sword. Do you understand me? Fire and sword. Septon Sefton took Dunk's arm and pulled him quickly from the room. Egg followed close behind them.
That was most unwise, sir,
the fat Septon whispered, and he led them to the steps.
Most unwise, to mention Adam Osgray.
Sir Eustace told me she was fond of the boy.
Fond?
The Septon huffed heavily.
She loved the boy, and him her.
It never went beyond a kiss or two, but it was Adam she wept for after the red grass field, not the husband she hardly knew. She blamed Sir Eustace for his death, and rightly so. The boy was 12.
Dunk knew what it was to bear a wound. Whenever someone spoke of Ashford Meadow, he thought of the 3 good men who died to save his foot, and never failed to hurt.
Tell my lady that it was not my wish to hurt her. Beg her pardon?
I shall do all I can, sir,
Septon Sefton said.
But tell Sir Eustace to bring her Bennis, and quickly. Elsewise it will go hard on him. It will go very hard.
Tyrion. They departed Pentos by the sunrise gate, though Tyrion Lannister never glimpsed the sunrise.
It will be as if you had never come to Pentos, my little friend, promised Magister Illyrio, as he drew shut the litter's purple velvet drapes. No man must see you leave the city, as no man saw you enter.
No man except the sailors who stuffed me in that barrel, the cabin boy who cleaned up after me, the girl you sent to warm my bed, and that treacherous, freckled washerwoman. Oh, and your guards, unless you remove their wits along with their balls. They know you're not alone in here. The litter was suspended between 8 mammoth draft horses on heavy leather straps. 4 eunuchs paced beside the horses, 2 to either side, and more were trudging along behind to guard the baggage train.
Unsullied, tell no tales, Illyrio assured him, and the galley that delivered you is on her way to Ashai even now. It will be 2 years before she returns, if the seas are kind. As for my household, they love me well. None would betray me. Cherish that thought, my fat friend. One day we will carve those words upon your crypt.
We should be aboard that galley, the dwarf said. The fastest way to Valentis is by sea.
The sea is hazardous, replied Illyrio. Autumn is a season rife with storms, and pirates still make their dens upon the stepstones and venture forth to prey on honest men. It would never do for my little friend to fall into such hands.
There are pirates on the Rhoyne as well.
River pirates, the cheesemonger gave a yawn, covering his mouth with the back of his hand. Cockroach captains scurrying after crumbs.
One hears talk of stone men as well.
Oh, they are real enough, poor damned things. But why speak of such things? The day is too fine for such talk. We shall see the Rhoyne soon, and there you shall be rid of Illyrio and his big belly. Till then, let us drink and dream. We have sweet wine and savouries to enjoy. Why dwell upon disease and death?
Why indeed? Tyrion heard the thrum of a crossbow once again and wondered. The litter swayed side to side, a soothing movement that made him feel as if he were a child being rocked to sleep in his mother's arms. Not that I would know what that was like. Silk pillows, stuffed with goose down, cushioned his cheeks. The purple velvet walls curved overhead to form a roof, making it pleasantly warm within, despite the autumn chill outside. A train of mules trailed behind them, carrying chests and casks and barrels, and hampers of delectables to keep the Lord of Cheese from growing peckish. They nibbled on spiced sausage that morning, washed down with a dark smokeberry brown. Jellied eels and Dornish reds filled their afternoon. Come evening, there were sliced hams, boiled eggs, and roasted larks stuffed with garlic and onions, with pale ales and Mearish fire wines to help in their digestion. The litter was as slow as it was comfortable, however, and the dwarf soon found himself itching with impatience. "How many days until we reach the river?" he asked Illyrio that evening. "At this pace your queen's dragons will be larger than Aegon III before I can lay eyes upon them." "Would it were so. A large dragon is more fearsome than a small one," the magister shrugged. "Much as it would please me to welcome Queen Daenerys to Volantis, I must rely on you and Griff for that. I can serve her best in Pentos, smoothing the way for her return. So long as I'm with you, though, well, an old fat man must have his comforts, yes? Come, drink a cup of wine."
"Tell me," Tyrion said as he drank, "why should a magister of Pentos give 3 figs who wears the crown in Westeros? Where is the gain for you in this venture, my lord?"
The fat man dabbed grease from his lips. "I am an old man, grown weary of this world and its treacheries. Is it so strange that I should wish to do some good before my days are done, to help a sweet young girl regain her birthright?
Next you will be offering me a suit of magic armor and a palace in Valyria. If Daenerys is no more than a sweet young girl, the Iron Throne will cut her into sweet young pieces."
"Fear not, my little friend. The blood of Aegon the Dragon flows in her veins."
"Along with the blood of Aegon the Unworthy, Maegor the Cruel, and Baelor the Befuddled."
Tell me more of her."
The fat man grew pensive.
"Daenerys was half a child when she came to me, yet fairer even than my second wife. So lovely, I was tempted to claim her for myself. Such a fearful, furtive thing, however, I knew I should get no joy from coupling with her. Instead, I summoned a bedwarmer and fucked her vigorously until the madness passed. If truth be told, I did not think Daenerys would survive for long amongst the Horse Lords."
"That did not stop you selling her to Khal Drogo?"
"Dothraki neither buy nor sell. Say rather that her brother Viserys gave her to Drogo to win the Khal's friendship. A vain young man and greedy. Viserys lusted for his father's throne, but he lusted for Daenerys too, and was loath to give her up. The night before the princess wed, he tried to steal into her bed, insisting that if he could not have her hand, he would claim her maidenhead. Had I not taken the precaution of posting guards upon her door, Viserys might have undone years of planning."
"He sounds an utter fool."
"Viserys was Mad Aerys' son, just so. Daenerys is quite different."
He popped a roasted lark into his mouth and crunched it noisily, bones and all.
"The frightened child who sheltered in my manse died on the Dothraki Sea and was reborn in blood and fire. This dragon queen who wears her name
is a true Targaryen. When I sent ships to bring her home, she turned towards Slaver's Bay. In a short span of days, she conquered Astapor, made Yunkai bend the knee, and sacked Meereen. Mantares will be next, if she marches west along the Ovalerian roads. If she comes by sea, well, her fleet must take on food and water at Volantis. By land or by sea, there are long leagues between Meereen and Volantis, Tyrion observed. 550, as the dragon flies, through deserts, mountains, swamps, and demon-haunted ruins. Many and more will perish, but those who survive will be stronger by the time they reach Volantis, where they shall find you and Griff awaiting them, with fresh forces and sufficient ships to carry them all across the sea to Westeros. Tyrion pondered all he knew of Volantis, oldest and proudest of the 9 free cities. Something was awry here. Even with half a nose, he could smell it. It said there are 5 slaves for every free man in Volantis. Why would the Triarchs assist a queen who smashed the slave trade? He pointed at Illyrio. For that matter, why would you? Slavery may be forbidden by the laws of Pentos, yet you have a finger in that trade as well, and maybe a whole hand. And yet you conspire for the Dragon Queen and not against her. Why? What do you hope to gain from Queen Daenerys?
Oh, are we back to that again? You are a persistent little man. Illyrio gave a laugh and slapped his belly. As you will. The Beggar King swore that I should be his master of coin, and a lordly lord as well. Once he wore his golden crown, I should have my choice of castles, even Casterly Rock, if I desired.
Tyrion snorted wine back up the scarred stump that had been his nose. My father would have loved to hear that.
Your lord father had no cause for concern. Why would I want a rock, eh? My manse is large enough for any man, and more comfortable than your draughty Westerosi castles. Master of coin, though. The fat man peeled another egg. I am fond of coins. Is there any sound as sweet as the clink of gold on gold?
A sister screams.
Are you quite certain that Daenerys will make good her brother's promises? Oh, she will, or she will not. Illyrio bit the egg in half. I told you, my little friend, not all that a man does is done for gain. Believe as you wish, but even fat old fools like me have friends and debts of affection to repay.
Liar, thought Tyrion. There is something in this venture worth more to you than coin or castles.
You meet so few men who value friendship over gold these days.
Too true, the fat man said, deaf to the irony.
How is it that the spider became so dear to you? We were young together, 2 green boys in Pentos.
Varys came from Myr.
Yes, so he did. I met him not long after he arrived, 1 step ahead of the slavers. By day he slept in the sewers. By night he prowled the rooftops like a cat. I was near as poor, a bravo in soiled silks, living by my blade. Perhaps you chanced to glimpse the statue by my pool. Pytho Melanon carved that when I was 6 and 10. A lovely thing, though now I weep to see it. Age makes ruins of us all. I am still in mourning for my nose. But Varys, in Myr he was a prince of thieves, until a rival thief informed on him. In Pentos his accent marked him, and once he was known for a eunuch, he was despised and beaten. Why he chose me to protect him, I may never know. But we came to an arrangement. Varys spied on lesser thieves and took their takings. I offered my help to their victims, promising to recover their valuables for a fee. Soon every man who had suffered a loss knew to come to me, while cities, footpads, and cutpurses sought out Varys, half to slit his throat, the other half to sell him what they had stolen. We both grew rich, and richer still when Varys trained his mice.
In King's Landing, he kept little birds.
Mice, we called them then. The older thieves were fools who thought no further than turning a knight's plunder into wine. Varys preferred orphan boys and young girls. He chose the smallest, the ones who were quick and quiet, and taught them to climb walls and slip down chimneys. He taught them to read as well. We left the gold and gems for common thieves. Instead, our mice stole letters, ledgers, charts. Later, they would read them and leave them where they lay. Secrets are worth more than silver or sapphires, Varys claimed. Just so, I grew so respectable that a cousin of the Prince of Pentos let me wed his maiden daughter, whilst whispers of a certain eunuch's talents crossed the narrow sea and reached the ears of a certain king, a very anxious king who did not wholly trust his son, nor his wife, nor his hand, a friend of his youth who had grown arrogant and overproud. I do believe that you know the rest of this tale. Is that not so?
Much of it, Tyrion admitted. I see that you are somewhat more than a cheesemonger after all.
Illyrio inclined his head. You are kind to say so, my little friend, and for my part I see that you are just as quick as Lord Varys claimed. He smiled, showing all his crooked yellow teeth, and shouted for another jar of Moorish fire wine. When the magister drifted off to sleep with a wine jar at his elbow, Tyrion crept across the pillows to work it loose from its fleshy prison and pour himself a cup. He drained it down and yawned and filled it once again. If I drink enough fire wine, he told himself, perhaps I'll dream of dragons. When he was still a lonely child in the depths of Casterly Rock, he off-rode dragons through the nights, pretending he was some lost Targaryen princeling or a Valyrian dragon lord soaring high o'er fields and mountains. Once, when his uncles asked him what gift he wanted for his name day, he begged them for a dragon. It wouldn't need to be a big one. It could be little, like I am. His uncle Geryon thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard, but his uncle Tyget said, "The last dragon died a century ago, lad." That had seemed so monstrously unfair that the boy had cried himself to sleep that night. Yet if the Lord of Cheese could be believed, the Mad King's daughter had hatched 3 living dragons. 2 more than even a Targaryen should require. Tyrion was almost sorry that he had killed his father. He would have enjoyed seeing Lord Tywin's face when he learned that there was a Targaryen queen on her way to Westeros with 3 dragons, backed by a scheming eunuch and a cheesemonger half the size of Casterly Rock. The dwarf was so stuffed that he had to undo his belt and the topmost laces on his breeches. The boy's clothes, his host had dressed him in, made him feel like 10 pounds of sausage in a 5-pound skin.
"If we eat this way every day, I will be the size of Illyrio before I meet this dragon queen."
Outside the litter, night had fallen. Inside, all was dark. Tyrion listened to Illyrio's snores, the creak of the leather straps, the slow clop-clop of the team's iron-shod hooves on the hard Valerian road, but his heart was listening for the beat of leathern wings.
When he woke, dawn had come. The horses plodded on, the litter creaking and swaying between them. Tyrion pulled the curtain back an inch to peer outside, but there was little to see but ochre fields. Bare brown elms on the road itself, a broad stone highway that ran straight as a spear to the horizon. He had read about Valyrian roads, but this was the first he had seen. The Freehold's grasp had reached as far as Dragonstone, but never to the mainland of Westeros itself.
Odd that. Dragonstone is no more than a rock. The wealth was farther west. But they had dragons. Surely they knew that it was there.
He had drunk too much last night. His head was pounding, and even the gentle swaying of the litter was enough to make his gorge rise in his throat. Though he said no word of complaint, his distress must have been plain to Illyrio Maupatus.
"Come drink with me," the fat man said. "A scale from the dragon that burned you, as they say."
He poured for them from a flagon of blackberry wine, so sweet that it drew more flies than honey. Tyrion shooed them off with the back of his hand and drank deep. The taste was so cloying that it was all he could do to keep it down. The second cup went down easier, however. Even so, he had no appetite, and when Illyrio offered him a bowl of blackberries and cream, he waved it off.
"I dreamed about the queen," he said. "I was on my knees before her, swearing my allegiance, but she mistook me for my brother, Jaime, and fed me to her dragons."
"Let us hope that this dream was not prophetic. You are a clever imp, just as Varya said, and Daenerys will have need of clever men about her. Sir Barristan is a valiant knight, and true, but none, I think, has ever called him cunning."
"Knights only know one way to solve a problem. They couch their lances and charge. A dwarf has a different way of looking at the world. What of you, though? You are a clever man yourself."
"You flatter me." Illyrio waggled his hand. "Alas, I am not made for travel, so I will send you to Daenerys in my stead. You did her grace a great service when you slew your father, and it is my hope that you will do her many more. Daenerys is not the fool her brother was. She will make good use of you."
"As kindling," Tyrion thought, smiling pleasantly. They changed out teams only thrice that day, but seemed to halt twice an hour at the least, so Illyrio could climb down from the litter and have himself a piss.
"Our Lord of Cheese is the size of an elephant, but he has a bladder like a peanut," the dwarf mused. During one stop, he used the time to have a closer look at the road. Tyrion knew what he would find, not packed earth, nor bricks, nor cobbles, but a ribbon of fused stone raised a half foot above the ground to allow rainfall and snowmelt to run off its shoulders. Unlike the muddy tracks that passed for roads in the Seven Kingdoms, the Valyrian roads were wide enough for three wagons to pass abreast, and neither time nor traffic marred them. They still endured, unchanging, 4 centuries after Valyria itself had met its doom. He looked for ruts and cracks, but found only a pile of warm dung deposited by one of the horses. The dung made him think of his lord father.
"Are you down in some hell, father? A nice cold hell, where you can look up and see me help restore Mad Arya's daughter to the Iron Throne?"
As they resumed their journey, Illyrio produced a bag of roasted chestnuts and began to speak once more of the Dragon Queen.
"Our last news of Queen Daenerys is old and stale, I fear. By now she will have left Meereen, we must assume. She has her host at last. A ragged host of sellswords, Dothraki horselords, and unsullied infantry, and she will no doubt lead them west to take back her father's throne."
Magister Illyrio twisted open a pot of garlic snails, sniffed at them, and smiled. At Valenta's you will have fresh tidings of Daenerys, we must hope, he said, as he sucked one from its shell. Dragons and young girls are both capricious, and it may be that you will need to adjust your plans. Griff will know what to do. Will you have a snail? The garlic is for my own gardens. I could ride a snail and make a better pace than this litter of yours. Tyrion waved the dish away. You place a deal of trust in this man, Griff. Another friend of your childhood?
No, a sellsword you would call him, but Westerosi born. Daenerys needs men worthy of her cause.
Illyrio raised a hand.
I know. Sellswords put gold before honor, you are thinking. Well, this man, Griff, will sell me to my sister. Not so. I trust Griff as I would trust a brother.
Another mortal error.
Then I shall do likewise.
The Golden Company marches toward Valentus as we speak, there to await the coming of our Queen out of the East.
And beneath the gold, the bitter steel. I had heard the Golden Company was under contract with one of the Free Cities.
Mere, Illyrio smirked. Contracts can be broken.
There is more coin in cheese than I knew, said Tyrion. How did you accomplish that?
The Magister waggled his fat fingers. Some contracts are rich in ink, and some in blood. I say no more.
The dwarf pondered that. The Golden Company was reputedly the finest of the free companies, founded a century ago by Bitter Steel, a bastard son of Aegon the Unworthy. When another of Aegon's great bastards tried to seize the Iron Throne from his true-born half-brother, Bitter Steel joined the revolt. Daemon Blackfyre had perished on the Red Grass Field, however, and his rebellion with him. Those followers of the Black Dragon who survived the battle, yet refused to bend the knee, fled across the narrow sea, among them Daemon's younger sons, Bitter Steel, and hundreds of landless lords and knights who soon found themselves forced to sell their swords to eat. Some joined the Ragged Standard, some the Second Sons or Maiden's Men. Bitter Steel saw the strength of House Blackfyre scattering to the four winds, so he formed the Golden Company to bind the exiles together. From that day to this, the men of the Golden Company had lived and died in the disputed lands, fighting for Myr or Lice or Tyrosh in their pointless little wars, dreaming of the land their fathers had lost. They were exiles and sons of exiles, dispossessed and unforgiven, yet formidable fighters still.
I admire your powers of persuasion, Tyrion told Illyrio. How did you convince the Golden Company to take up the cause of our sweet queen, when they have spent so much of their history fighting against the Targaryens?
Illyrio brushed away the objection as if it were a fly. Black or red, a dragon is still a dragon. When Maelys the Monstrous died upon the Stepstones, it was the end of the male line of House Blackfyre.
The cheesemonger smiled through his forked beard, and Daenerys will give the exiles what Bitter Steel and Blackfyre's never could.
She will take them home.
Ah, with fire and sword. It was a kind of homecoming that Tyrion wished for as well. 10,000 swords makes for a princely gift, I grant you. Her grace would be most pleased. The magister gave a modest bob of his head, chins jiggling.
I would never presume to say what might please her grace.
Prudent of you. Tyrion knew much and more about the gratitude of kings. Why should queens be any different? Soon enough, the magister was fast asleep, leaving Tyrion to brood alone. He wondered what Barristan Selmy would think of riding into battle with the Golden Company. During the War of the Ninepenny Kings,
Selmy had cut a bloody path through their ranks to slay the last of the Blackfyre pretenders. Rebellion makes for queer bedfellows, and none more queer than this fat man and me. The cheesemonger woke when they stopped to change the horses and sent for a fresh hamper. "How far have we come?" the dwarf asked him, as they stuffed themselves with cold capon and a relish made of carrots, raisins, and bits of lime and orange.
"This is Andalus, my friend, the land your Andals came from. They took it from the hairy men who were here before them, cousins to the hairy men of Ib. The heart of Hugor's ancient realm lies north of us, but we are passing through its southern marshes. In Pentos, these are called the Flatlands. Further east stand the Velvet Hills, whence we are bound."
Andalus, the faith taught that the Seven themselves had once walked the hills of Andalus in human form. "The Father reached his hand into the heavens and pulled down seven stars," Tyrion recited from memory. "And one by one he set them on the brow of Hugor of the Hill to make a glowing crown." Magister Illyrio gave him a curious look.
"I did not dream my little friend was so devout."
The dwarf shrugged.
"A relic of my boyhood. I knew I would not make a knight, so I decided to be High Septon. That crystal crown adds a foot to a man's height. I studied the holy books and prayed until I had scabs on both my knees, but my quest came to a tragic end. I reached that certain age and fell in love."
"Never a maiden. Yeah, I know the way of that."
Illyrio thrust his right hand up his left sleeve and drew out a silver locket. Inside was a painted likeness of a woman with big blue eyes and pale golden hair streaked by silver.
"Sarah, I found her in a Lycian pillow house and brought her home to warm my bed. But in the end, I wed her. Me, whose first wife, had been a cousin of the Prince of Pentos. The palace gates were closed to me thereafter, but I did not care. The price was small enough for Sarah."
"How did she die?"
Tyrion knew that she was dead. No man spoke so fondly of a woman who had abandoned him. "A Bravassi trading galley called at Pentos on her way back from the Jade Sea. The treasure carried cloves and saffron, jet and jade, scarlet, samite, green silk, and the Grey Death. We slew her oarsmen as they came ashore and burned the ship at anchor, but the rats crept down the oars and paddled to the quay on cold stone feet. The plague took 2,000 before it ran its course." Magister Illyrio closed the locket. "I keep her hands in my bedchamber. Her hands that were so soft." Tyrion thought of Tysha. He glanced out at the fields where once the guards had walked. What sort of guards make rats and plagues and dwarfs? Another passage from the seven-pointed star came back to him. The maid brought him forth a girl, as supple as a willow with eyes like deep blue pools, and Hugor declared that he would have her for his bride. So the mother made her fertile, and the crone foretold that she would bear the king 44 mighty sons. The warrior gave strength to their arms, whilst the smith wrought for each a suit of iron plates.
Your smith must have been Roynish, Illyrio quipped. The Andals learned the art of working iron from the Roynar who dwelt along the river. This is known.
Not by our septons, Tyrion gestured at the fields. Who dwells in these flatlands of yours?
No tillers and toilers bound to the land. There are orchards, farms, mines, and I own some myself, though I seldom visit them. Why should I spend my days out here with the myriad delights of Pentos close at hand?
Myriad delights? and huge thick walls. Tyrion swirled his wine in his cup. We have seen no town since Pentos.
There are ruins, Illyrio waved a chicken leg toward the curtains. The horse lords come this way whenever some carl takes it into his head to gaze upon the sea. The Dothraki are not fond of towns. You will know this even in Westeros.
Fall upon one of these khalasars and destroy it, and you may find the Dothraki are not so quick to cross the Rhoyn.
It is cheaper to buy off foes with food and gifts.
If only I had thought to bring a nice cheese to the battle on the Blackwater, I might still have all my nose.
Lord Tywin had always held the free cities in contempt. They fight with coins instead of swords, he used to say. Gold has its uses, but wars are won with iron.
Give gold to a foe, and he will just come back for more, my father always said.
Is this the selfsame father that you murdered? Illyrio tossed his chicken bone from the litter. Sail swords will not stand against Dothraki screamers. That was proved at Kohor.
Not even your brave Griff, mocked Tyrion.
A Griff is different. He has a son he dotes on. Young Griff, the boy is called. There never was a nobler lad. The wine, the food, the sun, the sway of the litter, the buzzing of the flies, all conspired to make Tyrion sleepy. So he slept, woke, drank. Illyrio matched him cup for cup, and as the sky turned a dusky purple, the fat man began to snore. That night Tyrion Lannister dreamt of a battle that turned the hills of Westeros as red as blood. He was in the midst of it, dealing death with an axe as big as he was, fighting side by side with Barristan the Bold and Bitter Steel as dragons wheeled across the sky above them. In the dream he had two heads, both noseless. His father led the enemy, so he slew him once again. Then he killed his brother, Jaime, hacking at his face until it was a red ruin, laughing every time he struck a blow. Only when the fight was finished did he realize that his second head was weeping. When he woke, his stunted legs were stiff as iron. Illyrio was eating olives.
"Where are we?" Tyrion asked him.
"We have not yet left the Flatlands, my hasty friend. Soon our road shall pass into the Velvet Hills. There we begin our climb toward Goyendro, upon the Little Rhoyne."
Goyendro had been a Rhoynar city until the dragons of Valyria had reduced it to a smouldering desolation.
"I'm travelling through years as well as leagues," Tyrion reflected. "Back through history to the days when dragons ruled the earth."
Tyrion slept and woke and slept again, and day and night seemed not to matter. The Velvet Hills proved a disappointment.
"Half the whores in Lannisport have breasts bigger than these hills," he told Illyrio. "You ought to call them the Velvet Teats."
They saw a circle of standing stones that Illyrio claimed had been raised by giants, and later a deep lake.
"Here lived a den of robbers who preyed on all who passed this way," Illyrio said. "It is said they still dwell beneath the water. Those who fish the lake are pulled under and devoured."
The next evening they came upon a huge Valyrian sphinx, crouched beside the road. It had a dragon's body and a woman's face.
"A dragon queen," said Tyrion. "A pleasant omen." "Her king is missing."
Illyrio pointed out the smooth stone plinth on which the second sphinx once stood, now grown over with moss and flowering vines.
The house lords built wooden wheels beneath him and dragged him back to Vaes Dothrak.
That is an omen, too, thought Tyrion, but not as hopeful. That night, drunker than usual, he broke into sudden song.